Atlantis is go again. I'm Pete Combs, and this is Aero News. It's Friday, September 8th, 2006. Pressed for time with a full and complex set of tasks ahead, the Space Shuttle Atlantis was once again Thursday night set to be fueled for a Friday morning launch. This after four previous launch scrubs. Now, some were caused by weather, but Wednesday's launch was terminated because of a glitch in a small electric pump motor that supplies coolants to one of the shuttle's three fuel cells. NASA says even though this doesn't qualify as a violation of launch criteria, it scrubbed Wednesday's attempt because scientists were truly baffled by this glitch. Thursday night, mission managers briefed reporters on their plans to go ahead with a countdown toward a Friday launch, even though they're still just as unsure of the glitch as they were earlier in the week. Let's listen in now to Thursday night's briefing.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's STS-115 countdown status briefing. Once again, we have with us today Shuttle Program Manager Wayne Hale. We have tonight International Space Station Program Manager Mike Seffredini, Orbiter Projects Office Manager Steve Polis, and we have First Lieutenant Caleb Nordgren of the 45th Space Wing Weather Squadron. We're going to have a decision today about launching the Space Shuttle Atlantis, and Wayne, go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. After a very extensive review of the last almost 48 hours now, the team came to the conclusion today that the cloud that we saw over fuel cell number one is probably acceptable to fly with. I'm going to let Steve Polis, who I think managed the discussion through most of the day, give you the details on that. We had another very fun and interesting mission management team meeting. I've got to tell you that if you ever wanted to see the difference between the old NASA and the new NASA, you should have been over there today. There was a chance for everyone to participate. All the data was laid out on the table for everyone to examine from the top of the agency down to the most junior engineer. We had a vigorous debate over several points, and we had many people give their opinions and arguments. And at the end of the day, when the mission management team was polled by Leroy Kane, who we've allowed to go home and get some rest, it was not quite unanimous, but very nearly unanimous, with just a few folks still voicing concerns that we go ahead and attempt to fly. Now, we do have one little analysis that's still going forward. That should be wrapped up at the tanking meeting at 1 a.m., but we have a high degree of confidence that that will show good to go. And we will tank, and if we get good weather, Caleb, we'll go fly tomorrow. And we brought Mike Seffredini tonight, who is going to talk a little bit about why we think Saturday will be a good day to fly. And he can do Soyuz math for you, because I surely can't.
Okay, well, good evening. First, I'll tell you that the station and crew are still ready for this flight to occur. In fact, we talked again to Jeff today. He's very excited and ready to go. As a result of the discussions that we've had over the last couple of days that we talked to you about yesterday and Wayne just touched on now, we find ourselves, of course, launching our first opportunity on Friday. And as you know, we had done some work with our Russian counterparts to look at deconflicting the Soyuz. And in fact, many of you may not know, the way we deconflicted Friday, we didn't actually move our undock date. We had originally planned to undock on the 17th, and that's what the Russians had agreed to. In order actually to get the Friday attempt, we had been protecting a couple of unplanned contingency days. And we had kind of figured out a way to juggle the job such that we could still protect for a couple of unplanned contingency days if necessary. And I need to touch on that just a little bit so you know what we're talking about. The plan, the dock time frame is relatively short from an ISS perspective. It's six dock days, assuming everything goes as planned. What is not in the plan is focused inspection, so we always want to protect a day for focused inspection, which we continue to protect. And we have a place in the timeline to put it if that becomes necessary. The other thing that we try to protect for, this is our first assembly flight in almost 4 years like we talked about. So we've been trying to protect an additional day if something happens along the way in installing P3, P4, and getting the solar arrays deployed, moving, rotating the SARGE, all these things that we need to do on this mission. So we have tried very diligently to protect a couple of what we refer to as unplanned contingency days. Now, in order to go to Saturday, it's very difficult to do that. And so we are now in discussions with our Russian counterparts to go ahead and launch on Saturday. If we launch on Saturday, we need to protect to be able to undock on the 18th. And as you know, 18th is when the Soyuz launch date is. So we've had some preliminary discussions with our Russian counterparts about that. They've been received positively. They're off doing some assessments, and the agreements are if we don't get off on Friday, we'll sit down with them and finalize. But today it looks like we can go ahead and do that. It doesn't result in a conflict with the Soyuz. As you know, just like shuttle, it takes a couple of days for the Soyuz to get to ISS. And the real conflict is when the Soyuz gets close within a few hours of docking, where the shuttle being attached to the stack affects one of their docking's navigation systems, referred to as the Coors system. And so this really isn't a close conflict for them. They just need to look at the data and get comfortable with that. In addition to that, we have kind of a choreography to do because we have the Soyuz launch about 04-08, I think, GMT on the 18th, and we have the shuttle departure. If we did it on the 18th, would be around 1300 or so. We haven't worked all the details on that. And then at about 01:28, I think, on the 19th, we have a progress departure. So we have all these vehicles flying around, coming and going from space station. We just need to make sure that that all worked out from a tracking standpoint and vehicle control standpoint. Preliminary analysis says that's all fine, and so we just need our Russian friends to also get comfortable with that analysis. So that's the way we'll proceed. We're gonna protect for launching on Saturday. And if we don't get off tomorrow, then we'll sit down with them and finalize those plans and go off to use the Saturday launch day. And that's all I have.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Polis. I get to manage the Orbiter project, and it's been an interesting 36 hours. 12 midnight, whatever day it was now. What is today? Thursday? Maybe Tuesday night going into Wednesday. We did identify the concern where we lost Phase A on the AC-1 bus and affecting our fuel cell number one. So from that point forward, there's been an awful lot of work that has been done. Yesterday, Ed Mango talked to you a little bit about what the actual cause was and where we stood relative to our understanding at that point. Today, I'll try and share with you what we were able to gain insight-wise over the last 24 hours and why we think at this point it is certainly acceptable to go forward, and our risk really is going to be minimal from a ability to support the mission perspective. We started with trying to look at, typically if we're having a problem, we're going to deal with it from a fault tree perspective. Of course, if you're going to deal with it from a fault tree, it's nice to have the hardware in hand, or software if you're dealing with a software problem, and work through the fault tree very methodically, tearing the hardware apart piece by piece, component by component, to understand where exactly is the failure. Well, we don't have that luxury here, so we took a slightly different tact. We decided to look at it from what type of scenarios could have occurred that would allow us to explain the data or the information that we collected from our ground instrumentation and sync those two up. So we created a scenario-based assessment. We didn't lose sight of our fault tree, though. We still have our fault tree that we developed, and then we compared the scenarios against the fault tree to make sure we didn't miss anything, and vice versa. Look at the fault tree and make sure there's nothing in the fault tree that wasn't captured in the scenarios that we developed. At the end of the day, we really ended up identifying three fundamental areas of interest and established rationale on why each of those three were going to be acceptable in terms of would it be a potential cascading effect, could there be a cascading effect failure for that fuel cell to the other two phases, phases B and C, or could it be a generic failure mode that might affect the other fuel cells 2 and 3? I think Ed did a very good job yesterday of explaining basically the concern is somewhere between the relay feeding into the fuel cell and then to the coolant pump motor itself. So it shouldn't be a surprise that really the areas that we focused in on is the electrical control unit. Somewhere within that unit, there could have been a fault that caused the signature that we saw. We also have a harness that goes from the electrical control unit, to the pump itself, the pump motor. And then lastly, within the pump motor itself, we could have had a short as well. After looking at all the information, we did some testing at Johnson Space Center starting this morning and into early afternoon. And what we were able to discern is the wire winds associated with the motor itself are 34-gauge wire, pretty thin diameter. I don't recall the exact diameter off the top of my head. But we want to understand what's the current capacity of that wire. And it ended up being, yesterday we were talking about 6 amps causing the fault. Well, the capacity of that wire actually ended up being on the order of 20 to 22 amps. So that told us a lot. All the other wires from the harness through the electrical control unit are much larger gauge, 20, 22-gauge wire type scenarios. So the current capacity of those wires are significantly greater than what we would see within the motor itself. So it started leading us down a path, well, there must be some reduction in diameter as a likely scenario of a wire that ultimately caused what I was characterizing through discussions today as perhaps a fatigue point as the wire started to, and of course it could have been something from the original build where the wire was actually thinner in a certain location. And then it started to degrade or some effect was occurring because this motor does warm up a little, so there is a thermal change. And eventually it could have been, and again, I'm talking in could have because we don't know. We don't have the hardware in hand. Could have degraded the wire diameter to the point where it eventually started to fail. And what happens with lower diameters, the currents going into the system and you have an increase in resistance as the wire starts to narrow down. Then with that increase in resistance, current being the same, we're seeing a drop in voltage, which is what we saw. And then eventually it opened. And it opened most likely because of a temperature increase to the wire to the extent it caused that very narrow point to go ahead and fail. So that is where we ended up in terms of most likely cause. Now, can I prove that with certainty? The answer is no. But even if we're wrong in the other three areas or other two areas that I talked about as being possible, each case essentially established that the phases B and C have a very low probability of being affected. Because for the other two cases, the electrical control unit and the harness itself, the most probable cause of those failures, if they were to have existed or do exist, is collateral damage. And you all know quite a lot about orbiter wiring. In fact, we went through an extensive wiring assessment, inspections after the STS-93 short. And looking through all that, that would be a unique occurrence, collateral damage, and we wouldn't expect that it would affect the other phases. So we got pretty comfortable if either one of those cases existed that it wouldn't be a concern to the other phases. And then similarly, for all three scenarios, if you have a single motor pump concern, a wire wind within the motor itself, or a collateral damage to a harness, that's not going to affect the other fuel cells. There was nothing unique or that was something that jumped out at us as far as how we process the fuel cells, all three of these for this particular vehicle, that suggests that there would be any concern for all three from a generic failure mode perspective. So that gave me personally quite a lot of confidence that we have a very acceptable fuel cell to go fly. Now, I think there's a graphic we can pull up or a chart. And you know, you might want to get into a discussion of, well, why don't we just go change this out? We know we have a bad phase A and get a good piece of hardware on a vehicle. Well, I'm going to suggest to you today, we have a good piece of hardware on a vehicle right now. And this is a 250-pound piece, and it's not pulled back far enough to really get an appreciation for it. But it's about 2 feet long, 18 inches wide, 12 inches tall, give or take a little. But again, 250 pounds. And going in to try and remove this is not trivial. It's not like going out there and trying to remove and replace a flat tire. It was going to be, a very sporty event to go in there. And the team walked it down this morning, and as usual, there are some hidden things that come into play. There's a couple of harnesses that were not previously identified that was going to affect the ground support equipment design that's actually been built that would support the removal and replacement of this fuel cell. So that would have to be modified to be able to go ahead and accommodate the removal and replacement. Not trivial. A lot of engineering work has to go into that and make sure we do it right. So pulling out a 250-pound piece of hardware and getting it in and out and re-verified and checked out and at the end of the day not having a problem, well, there's just risk associated with that, bottom line. So stepping back at the 100,000-foot level and comparing the risk we have right now with the most likely scenarios and the change out of this pump, it became a very easy recommendation for me to go to the program and say, we're good to go fly. We're ready to support this mission. I don't have a concern that we're going to lose this fuel cell going uphill or during the mission, and we're ready to go support. That's all I have. Caleb?
Good evening. Not a lot's changed in the last couple days. Kind of the weather we had yesterday, today, is going to remain in place the next couple days. Kind of what we have going on. High pressure ridge to our south. There's a frontal boundary. It's kind of stationary over the Georgia-Florida border. And kind of what that gives us is a prevalent southwesterly flow. And that gives us our afternoon thunderstorms. As far as for launch time on Friday, it's going to occur before the thunderstorms. It's earlier, which really helps out. There is a potential with the initial onset of the sea breeze to get some cumulus clouds within 10 nautical miles of a launch pad, or possibly an isolated shower within 20 nautical miles of the shuttle landing facility. So those are our two primary concerns. And with that, we're going with a 30% probability of Kennedy space weather prohibiting launch. And as far as for a 24-hour delay going forward, that frontal boundary to the north of us is going to weaken, and that number drops down to only a 20% probability for on Saturday as far as 20% probability of KSC weather prohibiting launch. So just to kind of sum things up, we're going to beat the afternoon thunderstorms. We are a little concerned with the initial setup of the sea breeze, possibly get an isolated shower or maybe some cumulus clouds. But overall, weather looks good. That's all I have.
Okay, thanks, gentlemen. We'll take questions now. As usual, please remember to state your name and affiliation. Let's keep it to one question. We, again, want to get these guys home to get some rest before they get ready for tonight's activities. And at the end of this, please, we're going to get these guys out of here, so please keep your seats, and we'll let these folks get back to work. Let's start over here on the wall today with Mark.
Thanks. This is Mark Caro from the Houston Chronicle. I think yesterday you mentioned this fuel cell is 30 years old. Has it flown reliably in the past? Has it done anything strange? Does it have a good heritage?
The pump itself, Mark, is 30 years. We mix and match components off of the different fuel cell stacks. So at the end of the day, at the fuel cell assembly level, there could be miscellaneous components. But there is an interesting factoid. This particular pump happened to fly on STS-93. Actually, this whole fuel cell stack in its current geometry and configuration flew on STS-93 when we had the short. So we looked at that very hard. And could there have been an effect coming out of that 93 event that would have caused any concern for the loss of this bus? And the answer, in a simple word, is no. We saw energy levels on 93 that were basically two orders of magnitude greater on 93 than what we saw in terms of an effect for what's happened on the vehicle out at the pad. Put that in a more direct context, roughly 700 kilojoules of energy versus 7, rounding up from what we saw this morning. So we analyzed all that, and the simple answer is there's no effect from 93, and The motor, AC motors themselves, are very reliable. We did a search of our PRACA system. I know we've talked about PRACA here before, Wayne and others. Nothing showed up for a motor failure concern. So this is a unique occurrence, and I'm quite honestly looking forward to getting the hardware back, tearing it up, being relevant, and seeing what we got.
Okay. Tarek?
Thank you. Tarek Malik with Space.com and Space News for Wayne. You mentioned earlier that there is one small test kind of outstanding, and of course you're going to hear about that tomorrow morning. I'm just curious what the nature of that small test is, and is it pretty critical depending on what you get back, if it's positive or negative, on whether you go ahead with tanking?
Well, yeah, I said Steve would talk about it. It's an analysis, not a test.
But. Let me go ahead and take that one. The fact that we're running on two phases today is a configuration that we didn't certify for. What the overall philosophy of the orbiter design was, however, was having a three-phase system such that all the pumps, motors, fans, etc., would work if we lost a single phase. So the fact that we didn't specifically do a test to verify the ability to go run for however many hours is not a concern. What the spec called out for was to prove that you could run for an hour with two phases. And we're making a supposition right now what the original designers were intending. But we reached thermal equilibrium in 26 minutes. So by the time you reach thermal equilibrium and there's no real change in state that's causing a change in temperature within the motor itself, they felt, I'm sure, at that time that after an hour it was good to go and there was no need to go do any additional testing. So what we're going to do analytically now is go back and verify based on the currents and the temperatures that we'll see from a slight rise. Actually, what we saw from a test that we did in 1989 was a very small reduction in temperature. It was 4 degrees delta from what three phases show. But go ahead and dot the I's, cross the T's, show that that temperature effect is not going to cause any degradation in any of the materials within the motor itself. So I am very confident that analysis will come back for both the Freon motor as well as the hydrogen separator motor, because right now we're planning on opening the circuit breaker. Not knowing conclusively what the failure mode is, we don't want to leave ourselves open to have a secondary short or an additional contact that might short again. So we want to mitigate that, and we need to go ahead and show that both pumps will function properly. And again, I'm very confident we'll have that data within a couple hours and go ahead and show that this evening.
We'll hear more in just a moment. But first, this AeroCast is brought to you by Aircraft Engine Services, makers of the aluminum V220 and V300T engines.
How up-to-date is your aircraft engine? Automotive engineering has advanced so much over the past 30 years that you almost never have to raise the hood. Why can't an airplane engine be just as simple and just as reliable? Now it can. Check out the new V220 and V300T from Aircraft Engine Services. The all-aluminum construction of the V220 and V300T gives these engines the best power-to-weight ratio in their class. Earlier aluminum block engines suffered from excessive wear unless they were protected with heavy steel cylinder liners. In the V220 and V300T, each cylinder bore is surface-coated with Nicosil, an electro-deposited nickel coating containing hard silicone carbide particles. The benefits of a better power-to-weight ratio include increased range and higher useful loads, with less of a trade-off between fuel capacity and passenger or cargo carrying capacity. The AES V220 and V300T, as simple as a car's engine, but oh so much more fun to drive. Check us out on the web at VAircraftEngine.com or call us at 321-268-3718. Aircraft Engine Services, the shape of things to come.
From now until October 31st, Cessna is stepping in to cover the cost of your fuel. With the purchase of a new Skylane or Turbo Skylane from a participating dealer, Cessna will provide a $15,000 multi-service fuel card. To find out more about this program, contact your Cessna sales team authorized representative or call 800-622-7495. This offer expires October 31st, 2006. So call now, 800-622-7495. 7495.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design for a number of reasons. Clarity Aloft headsets are known for the superior clarity of sound. They're lightweight but rugged enough to meet military specifications. Best of all, they boast better noise reduction than ANR in the speech frequencies that matter most to you. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to our Aero News special feature. NASA briefs reporters on the launch of STS-115. This briefing conducted at 6 o'clock Eastern Time Thursday night. Things may change with this launch, so you might want to keep in touch with Aero News. Check out our print website, aero-news.net, frequently throughout the day on Friday for updates on the launch attempt. Now, let's get back to that briefing.
Tracy Watson, USA Today for Wayne Hale. Can you tell us who did not sign on to this, the agreement that you apparently had from most everybody, and in particular, what was UTC's recommendation?
The fuel cell manufacturer, of course, would like us to fly with a pristine unit. So they have no way to weigh the other risks. They don't understand what risks are involved in the change out or what other the programmatic issues are. They would prefer us for us to fly with a perfect or two print, as we like to call it, unit. So they recommended we change it out. The safety and mission assurance people wanted to make sure that we were not under schedule pressure, and so they recommended that we change it out because they wanted to make sure we had the best chance at accomplishing mission success. So let me make that clear. They didn't object on a safety basis. They objected on a best chance for mission success basis. We had a quite extensive discussion about the risk versus risk and the puts and takes. In the end, everyone felt comfortable that it was acceptable to go try to fly as is. Now, the nature of this, if you think about it a little bit, we have three fuel cells. We can fly perfectly well on two, so we're by definition redundant. In this one fuel cell, we have pumps that run on three phases and to all extents and purposes run perfectly well on two. So we have this launch commit criteria and this engineering requirement document that says basically if you're down a phase, it's okay to go launch. So from the get-go in this whole discussion, we have never been in violation of our engineering requirements. So we had a significant discussion of why are the requirements like that? Why would not the requirements be to require everything to be perfect to go launch? And again, we go back to the heritage of the shuttle and the design philosophy inherent in the redundancy that folks back when the launch commit criteria and engineering requirements were written said, we put three-phase motors on board the ship so that if you lost a phase, you could still do what you need to do because everything will work just fine. Now, the cloud here and the reason that we have taken an extra day and a half, cost us two good launch opportunities, if you want to think about it that way, is to go beyond that level of safety to make sure that we have done due diligence in listening to weak signals, making sure that we are safe to go fly, and that's where we've come to. The discussion, however, does center, as Steve rightly pointed out, until we take this fuel cell apart and tear it down, we don't know exactly. It's a detective story. We've got clues, we've got evidence, and the most likely scenario, the most likely place that we've had a little problem is as Steve described. Because we don't know for sure, there is always the element that we could be wrong, and we have to recognize that. And if And given that there is always the potential that your clues have led you to the wrong place and you've come to a wrong conclusion, there is some risk that is undeniable. As program manager, when I am asked to weigh that against the other risks that are involved in changing out the fuel cell and so on and so forth, I believe it's acceptable to go fly. The risk is that we may be wrong and we'll get on orbit and this fuel cell will not function properly. And at that point, we're going to have a discussion about how much of the mission we can accomplish. That is an undeniable risk. I am comfortable that that is a very low risk, as are the other folks that voted for it. But the safety people did remind us that we are taking some programmatic risk, that we won't accomplish all the parts of the mission, all the tasks that we have before us. We do know that we will accomplish the principal, or what we call Category 1 objectives, even if the fuel cell fails. We probably will have some further discussions, but right now I'm comfortable. And the reason that folks dissented from going forward, and by the way, when we made the final decision, they said, that's okay, we've done our duty because we have raised our concerns to management. Management has heard us and properly heard us, and therefore it is a management decision to accept that risk and go forward. There was no further appeal, if you want to think about it, of the dissent, we did not, in fact, have anybody above the program level weigh in on this decision. There wasn't required.
Todd? Todd Halverson, Florida Today. I think for Wayne, could you characterize for us the risk you believe you are taking with flying the fuel cell in its current condition in terms of statistical probability against the risk that you take whenever you light the solid rocket boosters or the main engines or operate high-speed turbo machinery?
It would really be nice if we had a magic way to come in and give numbers for everything. And I think sometimes in the past, some folks have come to different forums and spouted numbers that really turns out had very little basis in reality. So my answer to you today is we do not have an analytical number that I can give you that is a 1 in X kind of a number that this would result in the loss of a fuel cell, which, let me remind you, is a safe place for us to be. It just would impact our mission. But when I rate it against the other things that you properly pointed out, I consider it to be very low. We do fly this vehicle in a very demanding, very risky environment. Like all space vehicles, the margins are not large, so we do take a considerable amount of risk every time we fly this vehicle. In fact, every time we fly any space vehicle, there's considerable amount of risk. And again, based on what I think was a full, open, and fully informed discussion that we had over the last 2 days, I and the other managers involved judge that risk to be very low.
Irene Klotz with Reuters for Wayne. If for some reason you're not able to launch Friday or Saturday, would you change this out before you'd make another launch attempt or wait till the mission is flown either late September or October? It sounds like at some point you do want to take it out just to see what's going on in there, but I'm just curious if you're confident enough in this piece of equipment that you'd fly this mission even if you weren't under this very tight deadline right now.
Yeah, thank you. That's a very good question. And I go back to the risk versus risk. Based on what we know now, and we could always get smarter in the future, but based on what we know now, even if we didn't launch by the end of this weekend for, say, weather reasons, I would not have the team change the fuel cell out. We would go fly at the later date, whenever that is, with this fuel cell as is, because, again, we're looking at the risk versus risk. It's not a schedule thing. It's the risk that's incurred in changing that fuel cell out versus the whatever small increased risk we might have for mission success. So, no, I do not think that we would change it out. Clearly, we would have some more time to do more analysis and more testing, and somebody might come up with something else. Who knows? But right now, no, I wouldn't change it out.
Bill, and then we'll come back over here.
And Bill Hardwood, CBS for Wayne. I just want to turn Tracy's question around and take what you just said and look at it from the outside perspective. And you say the vendor was no-go for whatever the vendor's reasons. SMNA from a mission success standpoint are the odds of that. You're racing toward the end of a window. Station guys have problems with the Russians and spacewalks and extension days, et cetera. What do you say to somebody on the outside who would look at that and say, that's obviously schedule pressure. These guys are hell-bent on launching. I mean, what do you say to someone who takes that position based on all the things that have happened in this flow? And don't shoot the messenger. I mean the question with all due respect.
Well, thank you. No. As John Young always says, no offense, just ask it. I think that's a cockeyed way to look at it. Okay, what I would tell you, no offense, what I would tell you is that without having a requirement, without having what in the old days would have been considered any credible reason at all, we have stood down 2 days to make sure that we are safe to fly. Okay, so we have gone the extra mile. And I got to tell you, from where I sit, it don't feel like we're racing to the end of the window, okay? We have a couple of days available for launch, and if we get the opportunity to go fly, I would like to take advantage of those couple of days. We're not really pushing. And I think that, as Mike has talked about in our discussions with our international partners, many times we set conservative kind of limits on ourselves, and then when we go off and really look at what those limits are, like do we really have to be undocked before the Soyuz launches, turns out no, you really could wait some number of hours after the Soyuz launches to undock, and that really is no problem at all. It's just way back when we first thought about it, we said, you know, probably ought to be undocked before the Soyuz launches. So I feel very confident that we're not racing, that in fact we have taken a very slow, methodical, thorough, and safety-oriented approach in this whole matter, far and above what would have been done, say, by folks in the old days, if you understand my meaning there. So.
Okay. John Johnson, let's work our way back to the front from back there.
John Johnson, Los Angeles Times. If I understand what your suppositions are, and I may not, but if I do, you talk. One of the ideas is this narrow wire that over time degraded. Is there not a similar wire in the other fuel cells, and isn't it possible they could be degrading and be at the edge of having a short?
Well, let me tell you what I heard, and then Steve will tell me whether I heard it right or not. What I heard is these are extremely reliable motors. We have run these motors for in excess of 10,000 hours. The motors that are the particular motor that we've been talking about, it's run about 5,000 hours. So it's at mid-life, if you want to think about it. We have never recorded a failure in any of our use in any of these motors that has passed our acceptance test to come into the program. And so what you have most likely is a random workmanship or some slight material degradation that is not likely to have occurred anywhere else based on our history of having so many motors run for so long and be so reliable. This is not, I'll say it, this is not rocket science. This is 19th century technology, AC three-phase motors. George Westinghouse used to do these things when our great-grandparents, you know, bought the first electric appliances in the house. So this technology has been around for a long time. It's very robust. It's very reliable. And in particular, these particular motors that drive this pump are very reliable. And what we are probably looking at here is a random kind of a thing, which has a low probability of occurring anywhere else on either the same motor or any of the other motors. Now, Steve, did I say that right?
Yes. The only thing I want to provide a modification on is actually happen to have the exact number of hours this motor was run at. It was 3,948 hours. The motor itself was certified to 10,000 hours performance. And when we compare this motor against the remaining fleet of 29 motors that we have on fuel cell power plants, It is, as Wayne pointed out, right about in the middle of what all the other ones are. It's within 55 percentile range of all the other motors. So there's nothing here that, for me, would indicate an impending concern one way or the other. I believe it to be random.
Okay. Sam, did you have a question?
Two questions. I think they're kind of related, but for Steve, I think, is the each phase of this Freon coolant pump, are they circuit breaker isolated, or is that an internal function within the box itself? In other words, there's external circuit breaker protection there, and if so, what's the status right now? Is open? I'm assuming that they've been isolated. And then the other question from a collateral damage perspective with shortened across the second phase is, are each one of the windings geographically isolated from each other within the motor itself?
Yeah. As far as the circuit breakers, each bus is isolatable through a circuit breaker, or not bus, but phase, each phase. Currently at this point, we have all circuit breakers engaged for the fact that the hydrogen separator pump is currently working fine on all three phases. As I think I talked, we don't want to leave the phase A engaged going uphill, just if in the event, you know, we saw a short and then an open. If we had a recontact, not knowing exactly what the failure is, you wouldn't want to have an additional short going uphill. So we're going to go ahead and isolate the system. The ability to isolate each of the phases, though, that's possible. But when you do that, there are some other systems that do get affected as you isolate a particular phase. And I believe in this case we have a pH measurement device that is affected when we isolate the phase A. And your second question was windings. Yes, we looked at that really extensively. And there is significant epoxy within this housing that basically retains all the wiring. However, when you come out of the epoxy, you do have some opportunity for overlap. And basically then you go into a separate, into a wire that goes into the connector and then ultimately to the control unit itself. So is it fair to, a lot of us talked about, is it isolated or not isolated? It is as isolated as you can get. And the opportunity for there to be a small location of overlap exists. But where we all gain confidence is when we had the short to open occur, nothing was picked up on any of the other buses. So that gives us a lot of confidence that the other buses are, from this particular failure mode, sufficiently isolated to not be a problem.
Okay. I do want to remind you, let's keep it to one question and remember to tell us who you're with. Warren?
Warren Leary, New York Times, for Wayne, maybe Mike. If we go to a Saturday launch date, will the mission in any way be truncated or in danger of being truncated? Will you get full three spacewalks and everything else you want to do? And in that, on that second day when you do the tile inspection on your way up, are you going to have to do a more detailed inspection because you may not get another chance later? Is there going to be any change if you go Saturday in this mission?
No, with this change in assuming that it does get signed off, which we have every indication that it will be, we would get the full mission duration. We would have both of our contingency days ahead of us, and we could deal with everything that we would on any other launch date that we've had in this window.
Okay. And can you reach over to Kelly there?
Kelly Young with New Scientist for Wayne. If Fuel Cell 1 fails early in your mission, Are you guaranteed that first spacewalk, or what's the minimum mission duration?
The current definition of a minimum duration flight, which is what the flight rules call for following a fuel cell failure, would include the installation of the truss, the solar array on the International Space Station, one spacewalk and one day to do the critical transfers. So we would obviously, if we got into that situation, evaluate very closely what we wanted to do and look at the performance of the other two fuel cells, but we would at least get that much done.
Okay. Lisa?
Lisa Stark with ABC. ABC News for Wayne. You mentioned that the reason there are three phases on this is though if one fails while you're in space, you still got two and you can run the motor. But one has failed before you're even going up. So the question is, how is it justifiable to launch with essentially no redundancy on this motor?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. I probably have not explained it properly. Having three fuel cells in and of itself is redundant. We can complete the entire mission from the technical power requirement with absolutely no problem, fly a perfectly safe entry with two fuel cells. And in fact, if you fail down to one fuel cell by powering off some equipment and taking a loss of redundancy in some other areas, you can fly a perfectly safe entry on one fuel cell. It's not what we'd want to do, but it's certainly capable of doing. So we have that level of redundancy for us. So you have to go back and say, I've got this redundant system in terms of three fuel cells, which are redundant, and now I'm looking at this pump, which is in one of the fuel cells, which has got some redundancy on the number of phases that it takes to run, and we appear to have lost one phase of one piece of redundant equipment, and how much redundancy do you need to lift off? Part of the launch commit criteria is taking a hard look at all of the things that are on board the shuttle and deciding what you would be willing to launch without. That process has been very carefully thought through, although sometimes not documented why as thoroughly as one would wish. And launch commit criteria allows us to launch in this condition. And so going back to the very early design, this is something that the original designers and the original operations people felt was an acceptable condition. So here we've taken, as I said, a couple of days to sit down and think through that and make sure that logic still holds and we're comfortable with it. And here we are. So I think we're back to the original design assumptions of the vehicle.
I think we're coming up on our last question here.
Seth Borenstein, Associated Press. Wayne, if going back to Tracy's question and UTC, you said they wanted to fly with a pristine fuel cell. Can you expand on, did they say it was a safety issue or what they said about that? And I guess the other part, risking the second question, but this is really only half a question, has that fuel cell and that motor flown since STS-93, or is this the first time it's flown back since that one anomalous time?
Well, let's see. This is the first time it's flown since 93. This is the first time Atlantis has flown for more than a few days. So, you get back in after a vehicle's gone through an extended maintenance period like Atlantis has, and you turn things on for the first time, even though you've checked them out, you know, you are subject to perhaps some things like this. Going back to the manufacturer, I think it's a very consistent thing from a vendor when we go to them and say, you know, would you rather us fly with your piece of gear in perfect condition or with it in less than perfect condition? Now, what do you think you're going to get? No, they did not consider it a safety issue. They concurred on the fact that the fuel cell is not going to blow up, explode, catch fire, any of those kind of things as a consequence of this failure. So it's not a safety issue in that regard. And so I think, and I don't want to speak too much for them, their concern is for the reputation of their equipment. They build very high quality equipment. It is very precise. I had the opportunity to go a few months ago up to UTC Fuel Cells in Windsor Locks, Connecticut, and walk around and talk to the people on the factory floor. They are extremely proud of what they do, and they should be. It is you talk about a small package generating this much power, and all you get out of it is water and electricity. You know, it's green technology that they're trying to adapt to terrestrial applications. They would like for everything to go very well, and they certainly don't want anything, and I don't think we should take anything back to them and say that they did less than perfect work. I mean, here we are 30 years after we put this little motor together. It finally, at $3,900 hours, finally the first one out of all the motors that we put together 30 years ago has had a little incident. That's pretty good. I mean, I wish my car was that good. So I can understand why they would like to fly with only perfect or pristine equipment. But sometimes you have to make choices, and there are other considerations. And I would rather not take the risk of changing this fuel cell based on what I understand the risk is of flying with it.
Wayne, thank you a lot. Thanks to the rest of our briefers today. A couple of programming notes. Again, the mission management team is going to gather together at midnight to give a final go or no-go for the fueling of Atlantis. The crew is scheduled to wake up at 12:42 a.m. and begin their final preparations for launch. And then the countdown should be resuming at the T-minus 6-hour mark at 1:45 a.m. And, of course, launch scheduled for 11:41 a.m. tomorrow.
You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at aero-news.net. I'm Pete Combs. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you at the airport.